Okay, it looks like we're about time here, so let's go ahead and start. Okay, well, thanks for coming after your lunch to our session here. We're going to talk about securing Windows 8 clients and resources from threats. My name is Chris Halm, and I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. That basically means I own all the security technologies that are in client, things like ALSR, DEP, BitLocker, AppLocker, pretty much anything in the box there to keep the client secure. Kind of falls under my domain, and if those features are shared in server, I own them there as well. And so we've got a pretty interesting agenda for today, but I'm thinking about adding something to the end. So I think I'm going to talk a little faster than I'd planned, and I'd like to bring some other stuff in, some new Windows 8.1 features that maybe many of you haven't heard about yet. So we're going to sneak those in at the end. So I'm going to talk a little faster. We'll still land the messages and give you the information you want, but we're going to try to cover a broader set of territory than I originally planned. So anyway, I hope that's going to work out for you. But I'm pretty excited to show you some new things in 8.1 as well. Okay, so when we look at the history of security at Microsoft, you'll probably remember that we had a big aha moment in Windows XP. We were in a moment where we were clearly not prepared for what at that time were considered modern threats. Maybe we anticipated them to some degree, but they definitely hit us a little differently than we expected. And so between 2001 and 2004, we released what effectively was almost like a new operating system, right? SP2 was a massive release, and it addressed many of the key concerns. It could deal with Code Red and Slammer and a lot of these terrible things that kind of surprised us. But it also changed our mentality in the entire company. We designed the security development lifecycle at that point. We made security the top priority in our product. We realized in that moment that if our product isn't secure, we will lose the entire business. And so we changed everything in that moment. And Windows Vista came out, and of course that was somewhat controversial from an operating system standpoint. It wasn't as successful as we wanted, but architecturally from a security perspective, those were the right decisions. That architecture is still there, and we sacrificed application compatibility to secure the operating system, and we just had to take our lumps on that. So a lot of printers and these drivers that didn't work, we tried to work with OEMs to rewrite their drivers as we could, but it didn't land exactly the way we wanted. But I think from a security perspective, we did the right thing there. In Windows 7, some of that hardware that was a concern, it kind of aged out anyway. We were working closer with OEMs, and we delivered a lot of new features in Vista and also in 7. But you'll see, all the way up into 8, we just kind of continuously add more and more security capabilities. And so point I'm trying to make here is that security really is one of the top priorities. We actually see it as one of the core value propositions for the product. We have customers who tell us that they're moving to 8 because of security and isolation. There's a lot of other value there, so I don't want to say that that's not useful, but security and it could be a reason that you may choose to go there because it's that substantial. And we're going to prove that here in a few minutes. So let's quickly overview the security investments in Windows 8. And so when we set out to deliver Windows 8, our goal was to deliver the most substantial set of security improvements that we'd ever done in a single release. We staffed and funded the project accordingly, and we're pretty confident that we made good on that promise. When it came to malware resistance, our goal was to deliver groundbreaking malware resistance, and that's what we're going to focus on today. So we're going to prove that, but that groundbreaking, that's not really hyperbole or marketing. I know it sounds that way, but that really was the goal, and we know we've landed that. We've got some great stats at the end of the deck, I think, to kind of shore that up. When it comes to protecting sensitive information, BitLocker's been a great technology out there for a while. It was difficult to provision, not because it was BitLocker, it's just difficult to provision encryption in general. And so we actually decided to make the speed and the provisioning process for BitLocker one of its key values, and we actually can deliver provision BitLocker pretty quickly compared to our competition, actually. We have 10, 20, 30x performance increases on the provisioning process, meaning as we encrypt a drive for the first time, versus previous operating systems. So it's very easy to provision BitLocker. When it comes to access control, we started our process of moving away from passwords. How many of you read the Matt Honan article about Kill the Password? Okay, so some of you are aware. So let me just kind of quickly recap it, because I think it kind of sets the stage. Basically, Matt Honan's account was hacked. What happened is some attackers who understood how Amazon worked knew that when you add a credit card to an Amazon account, they don't authenticate you with a lot of information. They simply ask for your name and the credit card. And so the attacker added this credit card to Matt's account. Well, what does what did Amazon use as an authenticator to validate a user? The last four digits of the credit card. So at that point, they were able to compromise the account by providing the name and the last four digits of the credit card that they just submitted on the previous call. So they were able to compromise Amazon. From there, they were able to compromise the Apple Me account because guess what? Apple used the credit card number as well as a way of authenticating the user. So now they own the email account. Then they went to the banking account and they reset the password, and then they got into the bank account, and it goes on and on and on. So this guy really was put in a bad state, and so he proved, I think, pretty clearly that passwords are no longer adequate. And so with Windows 8, we decided to start the process of moving away from them. So virtual smart cards, which we're not going to talk in much detail today, are a multi-factor authentication option that can be electronically provisioned to a device that has a TPM. That's the requirement there. And now you get multi-factor authentication using the physical device itself as your smart card. Today, if you have a smart card or tokens, you're carrying something else. With virtual smart cards, your device and its TPM become the second form of authentication. So we're definitely moving, and we'll talk a little bit more about how we're going to take that next step in moving away from the passwords in Windows 8.1. When it comes to securing access to resources, we're going to talk about that a little bit today. That's part of the securing resources side of the conversation. So I'll save kind of the conversation there for later. One thing that's central to our Windows 8 story that really has not been true in the past is the security, is particularly in the case of malware resistance, the security and Windows 8 features really depend on new hardware. If you don't have Windows 8 certified hardware or hardware that has UEFI version 2.3.1, you will be more secure. So in other words, Windows 7 hardware, you'll be more secure with Windows 8 than you were on Windows 7 on that legacy hardware. But if you have Windows 8 certified hardware, you have a game changer when it comes to malware resistance. And so malware resistance really gets a lot better, dramatically better, when you have technology like Universal Firmware Interface. And we'll talk about why here in a little bit. The second part of the hardware story is Trusted Platform Module, which we've used forever. This is going to become increasingly important because we see attacks actually starting to move away from malware, and we're now starting to move towards more of an identity theft type of thing where there's, rather than putting malware on a system that can act on your behalf and run with your credentials, we see them just stealing the credentials themselves and logging on in as you. So stealing certificates, passwords, these types of things is turning out to be a lot easier today than it used to be, than it now is on Windows 7, and especially so on Windows 8. And we'll explain why as we go through here. So that's kind of the build-up. So let's talk about some of the two key challenges from a malware resistance perspective that we wanted to address in Windows 8. So they're really kind of in the center here. If we look at the blue one here, we have the problem, or have had the problem in the past on 7 hardware, where malware can compromise the PC before it even starts. So things like Stuxnet, things like Flame, and all these kind of famous bits of malware that you've probably heard of, plus many, many other variations and variants of it, all depend on getting in front of Windows and between the hardware, so sitting in there in the middle. That starts first, and then it starts the operating system, and then your device is completely compromised. And not only that, if you look at the green box, the box in the red here, because that is starting early in the process, it's also going to be able to hide from Windows, and it's going to be able to hide from your anti-malware solution, because the lower you can start in the stack, the more likely you can compromise the things or hide from the things that start after you. So it's absolutely critical to build trust in from the moment that PC power button hits. We need trust. And so let's talk about how we get that trust. And as I mentioned earlier, it's based on hardware. So for those of you who aren't familiar with UEFI, UEFI is a modern-day replacement for BIOS. The industry will still continue to talk about it in the terms of BIOS. You'll say, my guess is people will never stop saying BIOS anytime soon. But what will be behind the scenes will be UEFI hardware, right? And so from a malware resistance perspective, the key feature worth noting here is a feature called Secure Boot. So Secure Boot basically creates a condition where once the UEFI BIOS-like technology starts, it will initialize all the devices and make them ready for use. It will then start a secure operating system, operating system that is Secure Boot compliant. The way this works is operating system loaders in the Secure Boot world have to be signed, and the signatures for those operating systems have to be listed inside a UEFI database. So if the bits that are trying to start are not signed and they're not in the UEFI database, they will not start. And this is a great story. Now, there's been a lot of drama about this feature. You'll probably remember when 8.1 first started being discussed, the Linux community was up in arms about it. Not really sure why they were so upset about it, to be quite honest, because this is not a Microsoft feature. This is an industry feature. Everybody was involved. In fact, it's interesting that people in the Linux community actually were involved in some of the secure boot UEFI work. But at this moment, UEFI bootloaders are being signed for Linux distributions. So that drama that some people still tend to bring up because it never seems to go away really has gone away. Linux is secure boot compatible, at least some of the distributions are. And so that's really no longer an issue. So pretty much everybody's embracing this with open arms, as they should, because it really eliminates that boot kit scenario. There's a couple other benefits from UEFI as well. We won't talk about them too much in this discussion, but there's a technology called encrypted hard drives. Encrypted hard drives do offload of the encryption from the CPU to the drive itself. That technology has actually been around for a while, but it's been called self-encrypting disks, so SEDs. SEDs have never been supported by Windows, although if you bring third-party technology like McAfee and Symantec, I believe that they support those, but what they're doing is they're putting a driver on Windows that's not ours, and so while it works on Windows, we're not supporting that drive. The reason why we didn't support that drive type is it really didn't have the key management capabilities that we needed in Windows to do a good job of managing it, and so we provided guidance to the IHVs, Hitachis, Seagates, et cetera, and they've changed the drives. Actually, it turns out it was only a firmware update for them. It's actually physically the same drive as SED, but anyway, they decided to rebrand these drives as called encrypted hard drives. So if you want to get a hardware-based solution that's doing the encryption, don't buy an SED, get an encrypted hard drive. It's important that you look for that brand. Those drives are just starting to show up. I know of one model, I think Western Digital has a model, or maybe it's Micron, I can't remember, but they're just starting to show up now. So take a look for those, and those will give you the best situation because the encryption is instantaneous. That problem I mentioned earlier where it takes forever to encrypt a volume, it's gone away. It's completely instantaneous with these types of drives. So let's talk about the legacy boot with your Windows 7 hardware or before that versus the modern. So with the legacy boot, you have BIOS. BIOS looks for a master boot record and it starts malware potentially or hopefully the operating system you want. When we go to the modern boot, we have native UEFI, we have a database of signatures, we have operating system loaders that must be signed, and you end up having a secure boot of the desired operating system. So this is an ideal scenario, obviously. So let's talk about the security of UEFI itself. So UEFI obviously will be a target now, right? Because the way malware would start before Windows would be to attack UEFI itself and try to find a way to get inside the database. UEFI firmware must be signed. In the old days, option ROMs, BIOS, didn't necessarily require signed firmware. Well, UEFI is a requirement, must have signed firmware. So the only way you're going to be able to compromise UEFI is if you're able to steal the signatures that are used for firmware. And of course, that's baked into the chip itself. It can't really be modified. So UEFI is very secure by default. One of the challenges that many of you have faced in the past is, and now that we depend on UEFI kind of for our security, we're probably familiar with updating BIOS in the past, right? That's always been a big hassle. UEFI firmware updates will come from Windows Update. So all those processes of updating BIOS that you've gone through in the past, that has now been put into Windows Update, and so we're going to keep that up to date. And so the notion of BIOS updates in a typical sense and all the pain has kind of gone away with this. From a UEFI perspective, there is one interesting feature here that's worth noting. So one of the attacks that we've had on BIOS is imagine you had a BIOS version that had a known vulnerability. Well, later on, somebody will patch that and that security issue goes away. Well, what do attackers do? They try to put an old version of the firmware into the system and then they roll that system back to a previous version, which is vulnerable, and then they attack the BIOS that way. UEFI can never roll back to a previous version. You're always moving forward. And so that's baked into the architecture, and so that type of rollback attack is not possible. So UEFI is dramatically better than secure for all sorts of reasons, and it gives us the secure root of trust that we can then build all of our security capabilities on top of, knowing that nothing ever gets in front of us, potentially. We can't say never because this is a security world, and we don't know what type of challenges we'll face in the future, but architecturally we believe we've engineered out boot kits from the architecture. So this is very, very good news. So the next technology worth mentioning is a trusted platform module. So trusted platform module has traditionally been a BitLocker feature. That was really the only feature that leveraged it until Windows 8. With Windows 8, we had a long list of new features that will take advantage of it. It's no longer a BitLocker feature. A couple challenges, though, are worth noting. Many of you know these. One is TPM isn't in all PCs. It's only in commercial PCs, and even then, it's not guaranteed. We've done some work to address that. In fact, I believe yesterday Intel announced its Haswell processor line. Haswell has a component called Platform Trust Technology. Platform Trust Technology gives you a general purpose security component, and we're able to put a firmware-based version of TPM into that architecture. So no longer do you need a discrete part, which costs a lot of money to an OEM, and thus is not in all PCs because of that cost. You'll probably never see it in consumer. But now that Haswell's here, now you're going to see TPM in consumer devices. Now we've had TPM in consumer devices with our tablets. So if you look at tablets, they have the Atom processor. Atom processor has that platform trust technology. PTT is in there. So we have firmware TPM on at least some of our tablets. And then, of course, ARM has TrustZone, which is similar to PTT. And, of course, ARM processor can have firmware-based TPM as well. So it was starting to trickle into Windows 8 PCs, but not into the desktop, very infrequently into laptops. And so now, with all these changes, TPM will pretty much be in every single consumer device starting later this year. And in 2015, we'll make it a certification requirement. There will no longer be devices being built with our logo, at least, that don't have this type of TPM technology. So how is TPM important? Well, it's important for malware resistance. There's a feature called Measure Boot, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. It's absolutely critical for that. We have technology virtual smart cards that I mentioned. It leverages the TPM. We can secure certificates. As I mentioned, we're moving away from the malware world in some respects. Not completely. We'll always have those threats. But the identities, the certificates and keys, people are trying to steal those directly so they can impersonate you. We're going to protect those with the TPM. And there's a number of other features as well. So let's talk about how we're going to make the system resistant to malware at its very core. So there's a development lifecycle process. We call it the security development lifecycle process. This is the thing that we designed when we got the big XP aha moment about how insecure Windows was. We decided, okay, we need to come up with an engineering practice, a design practice, all the way from code implementation to program management designs, all the way to testing. All these disciplines need to understand how do we securely develop software and how do we get through the development lifecycle such that we can deliver secure software. And so we've made great progress with each version of Windows, but I think we've hit a kind of a high point, at least in this moment. In the Q3 report of Kaspersky, Microsoft products finally came off of the Kaspersky top 10 list of products with vulnerabilities for the very first time. And you wonder, well, why was Microsoft ever there? Well, if you look at the total surface area of code, if we counted the lines and we compare it to the things that are still on the list, we may be tens of thousands of times more lines of code in our software, maybe hundreds of thousands of times. And so it's kind of a miracle, given the code base and the surface area, maybe, that we could ever get off the list. But we've done it through this process. So we're very proud about that. I know that's all marketing spiel. But anyway, it just tells you how secure the product is becoming. So vulnerabilities that we've seen in the past, there should be fewer of them, potentially, theoretically, based on this progress. So what are we going to do when the vulnerabilities happen, right? I promise you we're going to deliver a security patch to patch vulnerabilities on Windows 8. We've already done it, in fact, but we'll continue to do it in the future. I can't make a promise that that can't happen, because we still have human beings writing code. And as long as humans are writing code, there'll probably be defects. The good news is what we've done is we've added mitigations behind the scenes to create the conditions so even if a vulnerability is discovered, the likelihood that they can be exploited is dramatically less than we've seen on any other operating system we've released. So Windows 7 was pretty good in this regard. We had ALSR, and we had DEP. Those were great technologies. Those are supposed to prevent exploits. But guess what? A lot of people don't realize this. On Windows 7, ALSR and DEP weren't liberally used across the operating system. There were entire sections of the Windows core, oddly, that weren't covered by DEP. There were entire sections that weren't covered by LSR. So these were areas that when people figured this out, those were areas they attacked. And so with Windows 8, we've done a couple things. We've now added ALSR and DEP protection holistically across the Windows code. It's increasingly being used on applications because we've gotten the message out and people realize that's a good thing. The applications that would break because of ALSR and DEP have started to age out of this system, not entirely. And we've provided tools to allow people to turn on ALSR and DEP on legacy apps. It's a tool called EMET, and this is a very useful tool. And it may break your apps because they may be looking for hard-coded addresses, but in a lot of cases, apps will work with it. So if you're not aware of the EMET tool and you're using maybe legacy software that's not using ALSR and DEP, take a look at that tool and see how your apps behave with that, because that's going to increase the level of security in your organization potentially dramatically, at least for those legacy apps, which are probably not being maintained anymore. So at any rate, so we're liberally using it. Another thing we did with ALSR is we increased the level of entropy by many magnitudes of order in some cases. So we used 8 bits of entropy, which is basically the level of randomization. Well, now it's 32 bits of entropy, right? So do the math on that. So it's a lot more random, obviously, which makes it a lot harder for somebody to find a place in memory to insert their payload of garbage that will execute. So techniques like heap spraying and all these techniques that people try to use to, you know, get around ALSR and try to hope and pray they can put something in memory gets executed. Those days may not be over, but it's going to be, the bar has become so high for these people that it's causing them to move towards other type of attacks, I think, like I did, any theft and certificates and these things. So the system is incredibly hardened, and you'll see some evidence here, I think, that shows the impact of these technologies here later on. Now, Chris Valasek is a security researcher. He goes to Black Hat. He speaks. He's kind of one of those, you know, very notable, high notoriety people. He has a couple great quotes here. So the advancements from XP to 7 are, XP to 7 are leaps and bounds. So you do all the math on that. Well, guess what? 7 to 8 is just as dramatic in his view. And he's a person whose job is to find vulnerabilities and try to exploit them. And then, of course, his last quote here is like, I wouldn't want to try to exploit the system because it's become so hard because of these technologies. So way less vulnerable than we have ever been. The likelihood that vulnerabilities result in exploits dramatically diminished. And so this is going to have huge dividends moving forward. So let's talk about how we secure the boot. We talked a little bit about this with UEFI. So UEFI gives us a secure startup of our bootloader. And then from there on, well, that's where the next people are going to try to attack. On Windows 7, our boot process was extensible. You could add third-party drivers in there. You could start other processes in there. What does malware do, right? Malware tries to insert itself as early as possible in the boot process so that it can compromise the defenses that may be starting in parallel or start before the anti-malware driver so that it can basically turn that off or lie to it about the signature updates that it maybe hasn't actually received and these types of things. So the lower you can start in the stack, the better off you are as malware. And so what we've done is we've completely blocked off the boot process. It's no longer extensible at the low level. We now have the condition where the entire boot process is protected. Nothing gets inside of it except for the anti-malware driver, and that could be our anti-malware driver or third parties. We actually sign the anti-malware driver from the third parties, so Symantec, et cetera. They submit it to us. We sign it. And once signed, it's able to insert itself into what is effectively a slot in the trusted boot process, and we call it ELAM, which is Early Load Anti-Malware. So this is a position, think of it as a socket that you can insert into if your driver is signed by us and passes some certification tests related to performance and a number of other things. And so what happens now is basically we boot clean, we start the anti-malware driver, and then all the third-party stuff starts afterwards. So your AV is running, it's secure, and it now has a fighting chance to detect malicious things, including malicious drivers. So all third-party kernel mode drivers will start after that. And so ELAM actually is really specifically designed to actually scan drivers that are starting, actually, because that's really where you get some of the worst type of infections is from a driver that, of course, has kernel-level access, admin access, and then it can do anything it wants. So ELAM really is paying most attention to those types of drivers. If, in fact, somebody finds a vulnerability in Windows and is able to defeat ALSR, or if they had direct access to the PC and maybe they didn't have an encrypted file system and they maybe tried to replace Windows files, what will happen is Windows will actually automatically detect any tampering with any of the boot components. So as the PC is running and somebody, let's say a vulnerability exists and somebody puts a payload and they get around ALSR and they use that to bootstrap replacement of Windows files with their malicious garbage, what will happen is because the boot process requires, anything that starts in the boot process actually requires a reboot in order to go into memory. So when you have a vulnerability, typically you actually need a reboot for that to actually start being activated. Not always, but if it's a boot or a rootkit, it requires a reboot. So what happens when that malware hits the system, it's really lying in wait for the next reboot, in which case it would become active. What will happen is the first thing that we do when we reboot after we start our secure boot OS loader is we start Trusted Boot. Trusted Boot quickly scans everything to make sure nothing's been tampered with. And then if we find anything tampered with, we then go into a recovery store and we pull out known good versions of the files, and we'll kick out anything out of the boot process. So nothing really can persist anymore in the boot process. There's some things that we'll talk about a little bit later that are maybe some weaknesses in Trusted Boot in Windows 8. So we've fixed those in Windows 8.1, but in general, this is a huge, huge improvement in the system. There's a feature called Measured Boot that starts in parallel with Trusted Boot. So Trusted Boot gives you that trusted startup, that hardened protection process. But what if somebody tampers with something? What happens if somebody does a flame of the future, right, where they steal a Microsoft signature, or maybe they compromise SHA-1 or 2, and they can sign a binary that actually looks like it was came from Microsoft, right? That's effectively what flame did. Measured Boot's going to help us solve that problem, and I'll go into detail on how we're going to use this technology later in the presentation. But what Measured Boot is doing is when the PC is booting, we measure the firmware. And so think of these measurements as hashes that represent the integrity of these components. We measure the firmware of UEFI, option ROMs, all the Windows boot files, and the anti-malware driver, all measured. And all those are stored and then persisted by the TPM. And then later on in the presentation, I'll tell you how we're going to use those. But think of those as an integrity representation of the PC that we can analyze later on with some new technology that's going to come from 8.1. So let's just kind of review how this all works. So in the old world, BIOS starts malware. We have malicious drivers that are malware, and it's a pretty grim story if you run into trouble there. With Windows 8, we can boot clean. We have OS that will start clean. We know that our core, our kernel, our anti-malware driver are not compromised, et cetera, because of Trusted Boot. So this is a game changer when it comes to security of Windows. Boot kits and root kits are engineered out of the process on Windows. So let's talk about how we secure the sign-in. So we now have a PC that's running. It's healthy because we have all these great new technologies keeping us malware-free. But let's talk about signing into the PC. I know this kind of drifts a little bit off of malware, but it is kind of relevant, and I'll kind of tie it all together here in a little bit. But there are many different ways of signing into Windows. So you know of picture password, pins, and passwords, and all these things. And a lot of people have questions about this picture password thing. Like, is that really secure? So let's talk about how secure it might be and compared to other things that we're familiar with. So pins, we now have the ability to sign in with a pin. So you can use that instead of a password. That's an option. And so the typical organization will use a 6 or maybe an 8. We use an 8 at Microsoft for our smart cards and these things. We think that an 8-character pin is the right way to go. But if you were doing 6, which is what most people I talk to seem to do, that's like a million options. So to brute force your way through a pin, that's a pretty hard thing to pull off unless you know something about the user or they pick a terrible pin like their birth date or something like that. So that requires knowledge about the user. So if you lose a device, it's unlikely somebody's going to brute force their way into it. If you steal a device from somebody you know, maybe you have a chance. But anyway, it's 1 million potential options. When we go to passwords, you're looking at, what are we looking at here, 208 billion options for a non-complex password, and then we're in the trillions on complex passwords of 8 characters or more. So the likelihood that you can brute force your way into those without knowledge about the user is pretty low. So what about picture password? Well, we did some research on this, and there's a blog that I recommend you read if you want more information. But the net on this is you're looking at a really complex thing. We're looking at 1 billion? Yeah, so we're looking at 1.1 billion possible options there. The thing you need to know, though, is the picture password is easily seen. And so that's where the challenge is. So, from a security perspective, this thing makes me nervous. Somebody would have to steal the device, though. That's the key thing to know, is that the threat is somebody sees what you've done and they steal your device. That picture password is not stored in Active Directory, so they can't go to another PC and log on as you with a picture password that they set up that looks like yours. So it's really, you have to steal the PC, you have to see what it is. So I don't think it's ideal. I think you should be using things like smart cards, and we're going to talk about biometrics later on. But it is secure to a certain degree, but I'd really pitch it more as a consumer feature. We actually allow this to be used at Microsoft. We have interesting conversations on whether we should do that or not. So I'll leave it up to you to judge whether this is good for you, but you see the numbers there. To mitigate the attacks, though, we do have an exciting new feature, though. What you can do is if you're worried about brute force attacks on sign-in, Something that we had before was account lockout. So if somebody tried to brute force their way through my account, we would lock that account out, and then they would go to another account in the PC, and then we'd lock that one out, and it would go on and on. What we'll do now is with a new feature, which is device lockout, if somebody tries to brute force their way through any type of password, whether it's picture password or a smart card or whatever, we will reboot the PC. Well, first actually, we'll if it's running BitLocker, and that's the key thing, it needs to be running BitLocker technology. If it's running that, we will encrypt the protector keys, making them kind of inaccessible, and we'll reboot the PC and we'll put it into recovery mode. And so people can't really brute force their way through Windows logon anymore because they're gonna put the device after 5 attempts or 10 attempts or whatever the policy you set is into a device where they would need to be able to hack through a 48-digit PIN basically to get into the device. So we recommend that you use this brute force protection with BitLocker on your devices to prevent attacks on picture password or any of the others. So we talked a little bit earlier about multi-factor authentication. So I'm not going to go into too much detail about the Matt Honan article. We've kind of gone into it. But the solution for that is virtual smart cards. We strongly recommend you look into this because that's, as I mentioned, we're moving away from malware in some respects. People are going to be stealing your identities. This is going to be how you protect yourself against the malicious attacks of the future. There are many different options, right? You can use tokens, you can use physical smart cards, but this is electronically provisionable. It's very easy to use. Intercede, which is a company out there, has a product called MyID, which does management virtual smart cards that's in the market right now. And there are other people out there as well that are starting to adopt virtual smart cards. But this is the one in market solution that I'm aware of right now. So let's talk about how we secure things after the sign-in. All Windows versions now include a version of, it's not a version of Defender, it is Windows Defender. All editions of Windows have that. So if you have bring your own device PCs coming in your organization, you can be more confident about the status of these because they come with a version of Windows Defender, which is a very good anti-malware solution. I have a link in the deck to an article where there was some criticism and there was a comparison by a testing company that looked at ours and compared it versus other companies. And they provided a statistic that we think was not a true reflection of the performance of ours versus the competition. The short of it is they said that we missed maybe around 20% of the malware that was being tossed at some of these other suites. And that actually was true. The problem with that statistic is it makes Defender look horrible in comparison. So we'd like you to think about this in a different view, which is let's take a look at who was impacted by that 20% that they executed. It was 0.002% of PCs that we've scanned were infected by these. And so we chose not to prioritize those. We think that it makes sense to add signatures for those because they are malware. We want Defender to be good. But I think this 20% gap overstated the impact. And so I think 0.002 is a pretty good stat, right? I mean, we did 99%+ of the people who'd be impacted by malware were covered with our solution. So full disclosure on that. We like to be fairly transparent there. SCEP uses the Defender engine. So SCEP gives you a way to manage the anti-malware solution. So we recommend organizations use that rather than Defender. But if you have bring your own devices and unmanaged devices, Defender is going to be there. When it comes to the Windows firewall, Windows 8 doesn't offer any new improvements there. We just kind of keep up with the latest and greatest networking needs. And so no new real announcements on improvements there, although there are some changes. An area where there is some big change, though, is with applications. So applications are the source of most malware, right? In fact, Windows has become so hardened now that most of the attacks are and the successful vulnerabilities and exploits are on third-party software. So we recognize that desktop apps, because of the way they're architected, because they have system access, potentially, or admin access, I mean, they're kind of problematic in some respects. Desktop apps don't necessarily go away because there's certain apps that need to run at a low level, and like an anti-malware driver or solution is not going to be able to run as a modern app like we have on iOS or we now have on Windows 8, right? They do need system access. But most of the apps you're running today don't need that. And so we have a new app platform. They're called Windows Store Apps. They run on a new runtime called WinRT. So think of WinRT as, you know, we had .NET before and we had Win32. WinRT is a new runtime for applications. The beauty of WinRT apps is rather than having direct access to the system, other apps and your data, they have almost no access to anything automatically. So they're basically sandboxed. The good thing about our solution is that sandbox app does have the ability to interoperate with other applications, but the ability for them to work with other applications is basically defined in the other application itself. So this application has to be instrumented and say, I'm willing to share these two features or this one feature with another app. So it's completely gated. Today with a desktop app, if there's a vulnerability, let's say in a DLL for Office, another application would probably try to call that exploit, right? And then hit the system that way. So malware can, because the way our desktop apps are working, because DLLs are effectively public, they can be kind of dangerous. And so with these apps, we have the sandboxing. So this is a big deal. This really kind of changes the game. And if you look at iOS, iOS has been pretty successful. They got sandboxed apps too, and so now we have it as well. So this is a great improvement that we have on our platform. When it comes to Internet Explorer, Internet Explorer 9 had a great feature called App Reputation. App Reputation, basically, before you download an application on the web, we actually vet it versus basically a database. And if we know it's malicious, we'll let you know and we'll prevent you from downloading it. Or if it has no reputation at all, we will warn you and say, hey, we don't know anything about this. You may not want to download this, and you can make the choice. With group policy, you can lock the system down and you can block it altogether. If you're worried about unknown malware or unknown software coming off the internet, you can prevent your users from being able to start those. But by default, it's kind of a choice there, and then we block malicious software. Now, this was a feature in IE, and it's great for IE users, but the reality is we have people who use Firefox and Chrome and on and on, and while we want you to come to IE, and we're going to give you a number of reasons to do that, in fact, we already have, we don't want the people using our platform to be punished, at least in this area. And so we took this feature and we pushed it into Windows Core. And so now, regardless of the browser you're using, you now get this app reputation, which was rated by NSS Labs as kind of the best of its breed in the marketplace. And so we protect you regardless of the browser. So this is more of it kind of speaks to our perspective on security and how important we think. We don't want to put something in IE to make it better from a security perspective. We want to beat the competition in other areas. So anyway, that just kind of speaks to our security mentality. So let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about how we're going to secure secure resources against the unhealthy clients. So we talked a little bit about measured boot, and so that's where we're going to kind of close the loop on that. So traditionally with access control, basically you have a situation where you provision a user access to a certain resource, and as long as they can authenticate with their identity, with whatever form it is, maybe it's a smart card or virtual smart card or username and password, they get access to that resource, right? So it's entirely based on the validation of the user. It's not based at all on how healthy that device is. And so, as you already know, when a device is infected with malware, that malware almost certainly, its top goal, in addition to doing what its main intent is to infect other PCs. So as that PC traverses your network and goes to file shares, an example would be, I'm going to add malicious macros to the Word docs that I find on a file share. I'm going to put some executable that I hope somebody launches on the file share. Or, you know, there's all sorts of different things that they do. Those are kind of two common ones. And so it's all based on trustworthiness of the user, not trustworthiness of the device. And so when we move forward, we're moving into this world of what we call modern access control, which includes not only the ability to authenticate the user with new types of authenticators, such as a virtual smart card, it also will include verification that the device itself is healthy. And so it's going to leverage a series of features like measured boot, remote attestation, and enhanced access control on the server side to gate access based on the health of devices. So there's a number of different scenarios that we could list, and I'll go ahead and let you read those. And so this idea sounds really great. The challenge is Windows 8 is still pretty new, and so we actually need third parties to come in and to help close the loop. Well, we ship the instrumentation, we ship measured boot data, we have WMI, we have all sorts of information that we can share about the status of a device, but we don't have a remote attestation service built by a third party yet. And so this is going to happen when the market share of Windows 8 grows to an extent where it becomes financially viable. But we think with the changes we've made, especially in 8.1, that's going to start to happen this year. So think of this as an FYI, something to plan for in the future, that you're going to be able to add this technology, this remote attestation capability, probably later this year. If you're eager to do it now, we have a solution, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. The type of customers who are wanting to get on this type of mode right now, I have found, typically are defense organizations, government, et cetera. So if you're one of those people in the audience, we have some solutions to offer to you. And if you're just excited about it, you could add this to your network anyway. And so let's talk about how this is going to work. In fact, I'm going to skip to the next slide, which I think is a diagram that shows how this works. It's the best way to kind of talk through it. So this is there's lots of ways to model this and make this work. But this is an example of how we implemented a prototype, which will be published to CodePlex. So if you're a developer and you want to see how this thing works, that will be out in CodePlex later this summer. But basically, the scenario works like this. I have a bring-your-own device, so I've got a brand-new tablet that's non-domain joined. And the instructions, if I want to be able to take advantage of resources on the corporate network, is I need to register this with some portal that's on the web. So they register their device, and then it redirects them to an ADFS server that's sitting out there on the edge, which includes an extension that's part of this CodePlex POC. And so ADFS then talks to the remote attestation server. And so the attestation server is the piece that verifies the integrity of the device. And so in this case here, what we have happen is ADFS says, hey, do you know about this PC? Have we seen this device before? If the answer is no, the ADFS server will push down a client to the device. So it'll be some sort of software that will have the ability to collect the measured boot data and the status information, all the health attributes that would be useful in making a determination of the security of the device. From there, the agent then sends this data, this payload of data, and it's really up to the vendor to decide what's in it. But it should be measured boot data. It should be the status of the anti-malware solution. It should be the status of the firewall. All the things that you think about security, that's what that payload should include. It sends it up to the ADFS server. And then in this example, we actually show you how to enroll in a virtual smart card, which we think that's the best way of signing into a network from a bring-your-own type of device or non-domain joined device. But that's just kind of a side thing. So now we've got registration of this device. We know its health. We know its identity. And so now the device is going to VPN into the corporate network and access something on SharePoint. So what happens from here is the user, creates their connection and they try to access the site. The site has additional access control that says, not only do you need to authenticate as you also need to prove to me that your device is healthy. And so the site basically makes a request saying, you need to provide to me a claim. So claims, kind of an industry term. Claims are a new technology that are built into Kerberos, and a claim can include all sorts of things. It can include information about users, like the projects they work on, their reporting manager, what department they're in, all sorts of information about the user. But it also can include a series of information about the device itself. And so it asks for this claim. The device says, hey, I don't have a claim right now. I'm going to go get one from the remote attestation service. It then harvests this data and then sends it up. The attestation service verifies it, compares it with known good values. And then it sends the claim down to the client. The client then provides it to SharePoint. And in this case here, it's a healthy client. And SharePoint says, great, because you're you and you're also healthy, now you have access. So that's how this POC, this prototype works. And again, it's out there on CodePlex. The thing that's important to note on this remote attestation server is this set of information that it sends, this measured boot data that gets sent. Those are a series of measurements about all those boot components we talked earlier. The remote attestation server will have a database of known good values. So every version of the OS bootloader, every version of the anti-malware driver, the hashes, if you want to call them that, the identity, or not the identities, but the integrity markers of those will be in this database. And the new ones that come in from the device will be compared against known good values. And if they deviate from that, then it will be determined that the device is unhealthy, and then that access denied scenario can happen. So this is a pretty important thing, because securing the perimeter of your network, as cool as that is and as effective as that is, you will have people getting inside your network. And so you need to protect the client, the perimeter, and even the resources they're asking, that they're accessing. So this is kind of a new thing. Most people are not doing this yet, but the pieces are in place to make it happen, and I think the third-party software from McAfee's and Symantec will arrive as soon as we get enough market share in Windows 8. So think about that. But if you want to get there now, you can, and here's four companies that can help you get there. So General Dynamics, et cetera. So there's some pretty heavy hitters here in the list, especially General Dynamics, that are working with governments and defense to implement this right now, and some of them already have solutions that are in place. So this is a pretty exciting new technology, and I can't wait for it to mainstream. So we need to wait a little longer, I think, for that. So let's kind of add it all up, and let's talk about how Windows 8 security did. When it comes to malware resistance, we had some pretty awesome results. So this is a report that we do, or it's from a report we do. So the Trustworthy Computing Group at Microsoft does a quarterly report called the Security Intelligence Report. Version 14 was released in April. And this basically shows how secure Windows 8 is compared to other versions. It's sliced into two ways. We have devices that we look at that were protected by an anti-malware solution. Could have been Defender, could have been McAfee, or some other solution. And then we also have devices that report to us that are not protected. So they're not running any sort of solution. And you'd wonder, how could an anti-malware solution not be running on Windows 8 when Defender is in the box? Well, the reason why is people typically, not typically, but sometimes they end up going to a third-party solution on a trial basis. And when the trial ends, guess what? They don't actually renew it. And so they actually have a device that's unprotected. But McAfee is there, or Symantec is there. And so there's a lot of unprotected PCs, and the users just think they're safe because they've installed something, but the trial has often expired. So we still have a lot of PCs that are in this state, which is too bad, but we have good news. So if I was an unprotected PC, so let's imagine I'm not even running anti-malware, let's compare how secure I'd be versus 7. So we're talking about 3 times more likely to be impacted by malware. So all these features, Trusted Boot, Secure Boot, ASR, DEP, all these things we've talked about are the reason why this number is lower. Right? So we landed, I think, the technologies in the way we wanted, and it had the impact. If we compare it versus XP, it's about 5 times more likely to be impacted with no anti-malware solution. Things get a lot better when you have an anti-malware solution, of course. By the way, something I forgot to mention, we're talking about thousands of PCs. So it would be 2.7 PCs out of 1,000 would be impacted. So now we have 0.2 PCs per 1,000 would be impacted. When you're running an anti-malware solution, it's 6 times better than 7, and it's 21 times better than XP. So if you're running XP and you want better malware resistance, or you want to beat the clock on end of life, there's a compelling reason to do it. Another compelling reason is as soon as the clock runs out and we stop patching it, you only need one more vulnerability because we'll never patch it again. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what happens if the people don't get off of XP. If they have malware that can get on that PC, it's not going to be patched. And it will be you'll need one more zero day. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. So please get off of XP as soon as possible. So let's talk about what's new in blue. And before I get into the details there, I kind of set up a little drama here because as we were going through the Windows 8 cycle, and I've already kind of mentioned this a little bit, we did see kind of a seismic shift almost in the type of attacks we're seeing. It used to always be about malware. Now it's moving into the other areas that we've talked about. The level of sophistication of people who are involved in this has increased magnitudes of order. And so based on the information we see, and we have tons of telemetry data that comes from consumers, that comes from enterprises, and we look at this all the time, and we realize that there are really 2 types of organizations. There are those who realize they've been hacked, and then there are those who do not know that they've been hacked, right? In other words, you've probably been hacked at this point. And so we're going to, I don't know if we can prove it in this session, but we can give you some reasons why that's probably true here in the next couple slides. And so there's these threats that are familiar. So we've been on kind of a hamster wheel, right, for a long time. New threat, new countermeasure. New threat, new countermeasure. We do it again and again and again. We fix things forever on Windows. Well, those are familiar types of things, but now we're seeing these things that are very, very modern, things that we have not seen before, at least in scale. Most of the things we've seen before or we've thought about, but we haven't seen them at a scale, right? Code Red and Blaster on XP, those were attacks at scale. We think that these types of attacks will occur at scale in new areas on the internet, on devices, et cetera. So there are these modern threats coming. And so let's compare and contrast the familiar and modern. So we're all familiar with script kiddies, right? These are plagiarists who steal cookbook recipes and deliver variants of malware, but they know how to write code, but they're probably not that innovative. Then we know about cyber criminals. These are people who are pretty smart. They're probably experts. Probably not full-time employees. Maybe these are the anonymous types out there. So they're pretty clever, smart people who are organized with anonymous. I mean, very, very talented people. But I don't think we're looking at the highest end people in the industry necessarily. Although maybe these people could be if they got with the right outfit, because these guys are pretty sharp. But at any rate, now we're dealing with cyber espionage and cyber warfare, right? Very, very different. So these cyber criminals of the past are now getting replaced or being hired by nation states, right? And a lot of people think that nation states attack other nation states. That's not true. They are attacking everybody. And we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. The scary thing here is they have unlimited resources, right? These are full-time employees, right? They go home to their families at night, right? They get paid to do their work. So it's a very, very different world. In the old days, we had software solutions. You know, new threat, new countermeasure in software, and it's just on and on and on. Now, TPM and UFI, these are really critical, right? If you don't have UFI, you cannot defend yourself against a bootkit, which cannot be detected on a PC locally, right? You need to boot to a clean OS and scan the PC to see these things. Now, you may be lucky and you may notice weird performance on a PC that has a bootkit on it, but if you're one nation state, my guess is they can hide that from you, right? Stuxnet and Flame and these things, they persisted for a while, right? We now have Red October, right? That's been out there for years and has remained undetected, oddly, because it's like a listening post on any PC it's on. It's amazing how much data it collects. But we talked about securing the perimeter, and now I even mentioned this earlier. You need to assume breach. Attacks on Fortune 500 companies, that's the normal. Now it's all sectors and it's the suppliers, and that's the key difference. If you are in the supply chain of a big company, you're going to be attacked because they're going to use you to get to the big fish. And you may actually have information that's good enough for them, right? You look at a company like Lockheed or Boeing, right? Some of these subcontractors, these agencies they work with, they have very, very confidential information. They may not have the key, the whole piece, the whole picture, but they may have a very, very relevant piece. And so they are increasingly targets. So let's kind of move on with a couple quotes, and then we'll talk about Windows Blue and how we're going to deal with this new modern threat. This is in response to Flame. So when that came out, and just to recap what Flame is, Flame is a very sophisticated virus. Net is the people who designed Flame were able to use an MD5 algorithm, which was weak, and they were able to do a collision attack, so they were able to duplicate a signature, which is not supposed to be possible, but they were able to duplicate it, and then they were able to sign binaries as if they came from Microsoft, and because of that, they were able to insert their malware into some Iranian nuke facility or wherever else it was being used. But at any rate, trusted boot and UFI would never detect that. Right, because they're based on signatures, and the assumption is they're secured. Flame is a signature, right, that's trusted. And so it would defeat those systems. We got some good news on that that we'll get to in a minute. But anyway, the point is the security software that we have today is based on, you know, like today's threats. It's designed to protect you against, you know, cyber criminals. But now you're dealing with the digital equivalent of SEAL Team 6, right? The nation state with unlimited funds with the highest IQ people. Here's an interesting report that many people don't know about, so I'm going to pump up. Is anybody from Verizon here? No? Okay. Well, anyway, Verizon does a great report, so my hat's off to Verizon. This data breach report is great, has so much information. We look at it frequently. And what they've noticed, and they're publishing quite a bit on this, is that, hey, these smaller companies are increasingly targets. So if you think it's only Fortune 500 in government, this proves that it's not that true at all. And then this last one here, this is in response to a terrible thing that we've all become aware of, where military systems, F-35, missile defense, all our top secret weapons, bits and pieces, if not entire parts of them, have been compromised. And so Lockheed Martin, which was one of many people that may have been part of this, they at least commented on it. They said they're spending more time protecting their subcontractors, their employees, their partners, their supply chain than they're protecting themselves, right? So they realize that if we're doing business with these smaller companies that are not really under control, we have to pretend they're our own. And so they're spending a lot of effort protecting them. And so that's the game changer that we saw. And we saw this really start to hit its stride in the middle of the Windows 8 cycle. So I mentioned Flame, the undetectable malware, even with Windows 8 technology. So we're going to be able to detect that in the future with a new Windows 8.1 feature that does not have a name, but it does have a feature area name, so we're still working on it. We call it provable PC health. So what we're going to be able to do is we're going to be able to prove from the cloud that a PC is actually healthy. And so, in fact, I'll just kind of walk into it and we'll talk about exactly how it works. So what we'll have in Windows 8.1 is we'll have a client on the PC that's going to collect that measured boot data. It's going to collect all the security information out of Action Center. Is my firewall running? Is my antivirus solution running? Do I have the latest signatures? It's going to collect measurements of all third-party kernel mode drivers. So those are the ones that can do the most damage because they run with the highest privilege. We will take integrity measurements of those. We will bundle those on a periodic basis. I can't remember the exact rate, but I think it's maybe a couple times a day or at least once a day. This will be sent to a free cloud service that will analyze this. So we will have a register, or basically a database that has every known integrity measurement or hash of everything we've ever shipped. We will have a registry of all third-party drivers that we're going to start tracking those. And so when something new shows up, when an operating system loader hash or integrity measurement shows up in the cloud that's signed by Microsoft, we're going to know if we shipped it or not because we have the list. So Flame would instantly be detected with something like this. And so this can only be done when you start using cloud services. You need remote analysis in order to do this because you can't detect these things locally. You can prevent them locally, but you can't detect them if they're there in all cases. So what will happen is this cloud service will collect this data. This data is completely anonymous. It's absolutely critical you realize that because all it is these integrity measurements. So we're not sending any information, any names or whatnot. But when we are able to complete the analysis, we will send notification to the PC if we detect that there's any sort of tampering with any of these low-level components. So that notification will come in two forms. If we detect that a PC has something like a keylogger or has like some sort of Flame variant, we will tell the user how to remediate that. That may be running the virus scan or getting the latest signatures and running the virus scan. That might mean booting to Defender offline and doing an off-box scan and scrub of the PC. It may mean rebuilding your PC because there's some really malicious software out there that might even PBR might not be able to get rid of. So it may require rebuilding the PC. But you're going to be really glad that you got that information, even if you have to rebuild, because there's no other solution other than the ignorance that we kind of have now that we have these types of infections. Here's where things, I think, get really interesting. I don't know of anybody doing this, but it's possible that people are already in the market. But what we do is any type of malware that comes in, we work with Symantec as McAfee's, and we all look at this together. So we actually try to share resources to understand how the nature of malware and how it behaves. So we share this information. If we are able to determine that a particular malware variant that we find on a PC has the ability to steal a Microsoft account identity, you will know about that, and we will work with you to remediate that account. So this is a pretty big deal because I would suspect some people in the audience who are using a Microsoft account or maybe some other account have had it compromised and been contacted by the company that they've been that their account's been compromised and gone through the remediation process. But you know when that happened? That happened when they knew an attacker got inside their perimeter and stole a database with username and passwords. We're going to find out about this because of malware that has the potential to steal identity. So it's a kind of a new twist. And so we're pretty excited about this feature. This feature will ship in a couple parts. The first part, the cloud service and the client piece that does the harvesting of the data, will ship in the box at GA in Windows 8.1. The remediation process will ship after Windows 8.1, but before a new major version of Windows. We're just not able to get it all done right on that GA date, so these pieces will come, these remediation pieces that let you know when the PC has an issue, those will come out sometime after. We don't have an exact date, but when we're a little closer and understand the sizing, we're going to publish that info. But this is not something that gets delivered in two operating system versions. This is something that comes out shortly after release. Okay, what about the improvements to Defender? Well, the problem with antivirus is it's signature-based oftentimes, and so that's the hamster wheel thing where, you know, new threat, new signature, and it goes on and on and on and on. What we are doing is we're looking at the behavior of malware, and when we cook it all down, we actually find that most malware is using cookbook techniques to maybe not exploit the system, but once they get onto the system, they're using the same type of behaviors to do whatever it is they're doing. So if they're part of a botnet, they behave in a certain way. They talk to these servers over in this certain place, or they look at the file system looking for certain types of information this way. So we kind of know now, after we've seen these, that there are a small set of very routine behaviors that these have. They're all shared. There will be new unique ones that come out in the future, but most of them are sharing the same things, because most people are just I wouldn't call them script kiddies, but they're kind of ripping off. They have a cookbook that they use, in short. So we're adding network monitoring behavior to Windows. So these well-known patterns of behavior will be baked into a network monitoring behavior solution, and that will ship with Windows Defender. And of course, that then comes with SCEP as well. So SCEP uses the Defender engine, so they're going to benefit from this as well. So this is going to allow us to see unknown, brand new variants of familiar malware we've seen in the past, because that's what they do, right? They change the name, they change the binaries, and a new one comes out. Does the exact same thing. So this is going to be very helpful. Last one here is about Internet Explorer. And it's actually really not about Internet Explorer specifically. It's really about browsers. But Internet Explorer probably will be the first browser that's released that uses this functionality. Today, you're familiar with browser extensions, things like Flash, ActiveX. What happens is the binary extension receives a payload from the website, and then it executes it. And then if there's something malicious, then your anti-malware solution detects and picks it up, hopefully. And it's after the infection has happened. So it's a very reactive way of doing things. We've put a malware scanning process, or an API, that the browser can hook into. So when it receives the payload, it'll send it to the anti-malware solution, which will scan it. And then if it's good, then it gets executed. So this is going to prevent a lot of infection types we see with some of these binary extensions. Now, we've kind of started to move towards modern browsers that don't have these, but the reality is we still have people using XP and IE6. So I don't think that ActiveX is going anywhere anytime soon. And so this is going to provide a lot of additional protection, particularly for those type of scenarios. So that covers everything. But we have a little bit of time. I want to show you one Windows 8.1 feature that I'm kind of excited about. So I'm kind of going off track here, but I mentioned that I would. So let me show you something, because I don't want to talk through the boring, like, go see these other sessions, because you already know what sessions you're going to see. So let's see here. Hopefully my boss Stella's not in the audience. I'm not supposed to say that. All right. Okay, with Windows 8.1, or with Windows 8, we talked about virtual smart cards, trying to get away from the password. In Windows 8.1, we're going to take it to the next step. So we've had biometrics in the Windows operating system for a long time. Almost nobody uses it. In fact, is there anybody in the audience using biometrics? Okay, that's about right. So I'm just going to guess it's like maybe less than 10% of the people. So it's a pretty cool experience. But it's kind of challenging the way it's currently implemented, because in order to use it, you need to go to a third party to add an enrollment experience. And because it's from a third party, it's not really integrated in Windows. And so also, I think the technology in most shipping devices is not the greatest out there. And so there's been a lot of advancement in recent times here. And so what I'm showing you here under the Wolf Vision is a prototype device. You know, it weighs like a pound. It doesn't need to, but they want it to be weighty. But fingerprint cards is one of many. I shouldn't have done that, because now it has to refocus. Oh, no. Okay, there we go. I just need to tell it to refocus. Okay, good. So the key thing that's important here is this little surface in the middle. Okay. If you have a laptop today that's a Lenovo, and maybe there are other types, you've seen the swipe-based fingerprint card, right? And so it takes some dexterity to get it to work, right? Most people do it once or twice, and when you've used it for a long time, you're pretty good. Maybe you do it once. It's kind of like a password. You try it two or three times, and then you finally get in, and it's six times on Monday mornings. But this is a touch-based surface, and that's the game changer here. And so this touch-based surface, in milliseconds, can detect your entire fingerprint. It can detect it with a three-dimensional view. This particular device actually injects current super fast in your finger, and it's able to detect what we call liveness. So basically, this is not an electrocardiogram, but that's probably the easiest way to kind of liken it. But this will know the difference between a live finger and a dead finger. Basically, I can sign into anything in less than a second with this. So this is pretty cool stuff. Now, this is expensive. This device, there are devices like this. They often look like mice, actually, if you've seen them. But they're over $100. They can be $200. They can be $300. And the reason why is the people who are using them are people who have a who need that higher level of security. So they're expensive. So I'm just going to venture to guess that they're selling them in quantities in the hundreds of thousands. We are going all in on biometrics on 8.1, and these things are going to be sold in the hundreds of millions, and the price of this part is going to be trivial compared to where we've been in the past. So we are on a road to including touch-based sensors on all ranges of devices, anywhere from tablets to all-in-ones to laptops to keyboards. Wherever it makes sense to have a biometric reader, the cost will make sense to implement it there. And so we're going really kind of all in on this. And so let me kind of show you what the experience is by plugging this in to my device. Okay. Anybody know who this is? Any Canadians here? That's right. Yeah, so he's your national hero last year, athlete of the year of Canada. So I'm a big fan of cycling. So I've plugged this thing in. I didn't hear it detect it. So sometimes because the drivers are new, when it goes into hibernation or sleep, sometimes the drivers pick up. So I'm hoping it will work here. If not, we can quickly fix it. But the remember how it is when you sign in right now with your password, it takes you a couple times. Well, I can sign in less than a second, right? Instantly, reliably, 100% of the time. Something else you may not have noticed. Thank you. Something else you may not have noticed is I didn't need to select a profile. So I kind of like flicking the lock screen up. It's kind of a fine experience, but I don't need to do that anymore. It will automatically detect the identity and log you instantly into the appropriate profile. So that's kind of nice. It's just a better way of getting into your PC, less gymnastics, less friction. There's an app here that I want to show you here. This is a prototype app that we've got, and I want to show it to you because it's going to show an API that we've added to our system. So today when you sign in as you, whoever is on that device has access to anything on your desktop, all the files, all these types of things. Oftentimes we're sharing our devices with family members, and if I have a banking app, I might not trust my 15-year-old. They may want to know what my net worth is, and they wouldn't be able to brag about it in my case, but they might tell their friends anyway. But I don't want them getting into access to certain apps. So applications will have the choice of basically putting a gate in front of anything they want. In this case, we've added it in the startup of the app. So the app isn't even accessible until I sign in with my biometric identity. So I'm verifying that, yes, it's still me in front of the PC and not somebody else. This API can be sprinkled anywhere within the application. So maybe I'm going to let somebody get into my Bank of America app, which if you've looked at that one, it doesn't have all your personal information up front. It has your name, but it doesn't have your ability to make transactions and whatnot. So maybe when I drill into that app and maybe I want to sell shares or want to move money, maybe we would use the API or they would use the API there to gate that type of transaction. So this is a very promising feature in that you'll be able to better secure your system. But the important part is we could have done that with passwords. Right. In fact, a lot of apps do, but what do we? They always have that little checkbox that says, save password, never ask me again because it's too much hassle. This is good, right, because it takes less than a second. There's no friction. So this is going to show up across all the experiences that you want them in, and it's not going to represent friction. It's just going to increase your overall security. So this is a big deal for us. Another thing you'll be able to do is, let's imagine that I have an application that generates some sort of output. So maybe there's a file that has information about me. Maybe it's, perfect example is taxes. So I go into TurboTax, I create my tax document, I save it to the disk. Well, that app actually could add biometric verification on top of that file. So before somebody can look at your tax form, we then have to verify. Now what you can't do, and I want to be really clear on this because some reporters got it mixed up earlier this week, is I can't go into a Windows Explorer and select all of my pictures and say, I want to protect those with biometrics. The application has to be instrumented with the API to put this additional ACL, if you want to call it that, on the content it creates. So, but maybe there's a potential to put it in an Explorer. It's not going to be there in 8.1, but just want to make sure that people don't make the leap that this is everywhere. It's going to be app-specific, and the byproducts or the files that they create can be gated with this extra functionality. So we're very excited, which is why I take the time. I know I cut into the Q&A, but this feature is pretty cool. So with that, we have some time for Q&A. So if anybody wants to get up to the mic, let's go ahead and have you maybe come to the mic so we can hear your question.
I have a quick question on the security thing where you do the fingerprint.
Yep.
Is it possible that once you log into the computer, that if someone else comes and they press a fingerprint, they can log into whatever application that is? I mean, you want them to.
Okay. So I almost feel like I planted you in the audience because I forgot to show something, and let me show you how we prevent that. So let me show you the enrollment experience. Oops. Let me go to the enrollment experience. And so in Windows 7, you had to go to a third party to enroll your fingerprint. So in Windows 8.1, which I'm showing you here, I can add my biometric identity here. So the scenario he's talking about is, so where we go? Oops, went to the wrong place. The scenario he's talking about is where I'm logged into my device as me, and I hand it to my kid, and they enroll their fingerprint, and now they're me when I'm not around, right? Okay, perfect. So what we do is before we enroll a new identity into the PC, so we go into our accounts, we go into sign-in options, you'll see all the different options. They can do passwords, picture password, etc. I'm going to add another account. It's going to verify that the owner of the device is actually here. So I'm going to sign in with my index finger, and then I'm going to go sign in my new identity, which will not be my index finger. I'll do it with my pinky. And now I've registered that. So that's going to prevent my kid from taking the PC that I give him to him in the back seat and then going, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to add my own biometric identity to the PC so I can be dad when he's not around. So that's a pretty cool feature there. Actually, it's not a cool feature. It's a required feature in my view. One thing you may have noticed, too, is if you've used the swipe biometric controllers, it will take you 5, 6, 7 times because they're not very reliable. It took me 2 swipes. It actually got the swipe, but the touch the very first time, but it confirms it a second time just to make sure there's no mistakes. So it's super fast, super efficient, frictionless, et cetera. So let's move on to any other questions.
Hey, okay, so I'm shopping around, and let's say I find a Windows-certified ARM device that's going to be running Windows 8.1 I really like.
A Windows 8, which one? Certified?
A Windows-certified ARM device.
Oh, ARM device. Okay, I want to make sure I heard that.
It's running Windows 8.1. I really like it. Take it home for a few months. A little bit later on, I decide I want to learn about Linux. So I go ahead and try and build a Linux from scratch on it.
Okay.
Am I going to be able to do that?
On a RT device?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So why don't you enable users to disable secure boot
on that device? It's for security reasons on that device. So if you want to run
Intel
Linux on a device, we have a giant ecosystem of alternative devices where you can do that.
Yeah.
But with the ARM device, we've decided not to allow that.
What were the reasons behind that decision?
Well, because somebody can turn off secure boot and a PC can be vulnerable is one reason.
So how is it different than an Intel or another?
Yeah, I know. We'll have to take that question offline. But I see your point. The key thing I think it's important is we believe in the ecosystem. We are not putting policy in place that would prevent the use of Linux on Windows PCs, but for this version, which is really more of a consumer electronics device than a PC that's extendable and extensible and you can run whatever you want, we've decided to make that choice for that one device. We are not trying to move into the PC ecosystem. So that's our position at this point.
Okay,
yeah,
and I mean, I guess I would say that that's probably why people still have concerns about UEFI, secure boot, et cetera. You don't know what the issue is, but I would say there are still issues out there that need addressing.
Possibly.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any more questions?
Does the biometrics tie into AD?
Does the biometric, I'm sorry?
Does it tie into AD, Active Directory?
Ah.
So as I go through my company, can I go to different devices and
absolutely not. It would really be nice if it was in some respects, but it would be really awful from a privacy concern. So our goal of biometrics is not to create a store of biometric identities. So your biometric identity is only stored locally, and it is not going to be centrally stored. So that was critical. In fact, there are some devices, not this particular model, where not even Windows gets access to the biometric identity. It gets a representation. They call it a template. So some of the devices will actually never let the biometric imprint even leave the device itself.
And the EFI updates, you said they're going to come down through Update Manager. I assume then I'll be able to see those in the MDT to put them in when I'm deploying my images?
Absolutely. I'm not real familiar with the provisioning process of MDT, but yeah, anything that comes from Windows Store should be able to be bundled into the new images that you provision in the future. I'm not real familiar with the exact process, though, but yes.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Yeah, so with the platform trust technology, is that going to be useful in TPM-restricted areas like China, Russia, that kind of stuff, or Is there?
Yeah, there's been a lot of progress there. So a year ago, yeah, you're saying it's no longer an issue in Russia? Yeah, there's a lot of indication. I mean, we don't want to speak about the legal terms here, but I'm tending to agree with that. What our view is you need to work with your legal department because there are some ambiguities, you know, depending on who you talk to type of scenarios. Here's what we did. In TPM 1.2, we had a hard-coded algorithm. In TPM 2.0, you can add any algorithm you want. So that could be the Russian NOST or whatever it's called.
Right.
China has their own encryption algorithm. So you can add that to TPM, and they were very happy about that. So they look like they will approve it. We're in the process of working with the red tape, basically. But just make sure you don't send somebody to Russia with a TPM. Until your legal department is verified, but we think that, we're in good place.
We've seen some improvements with it as well, but we're not entirely confident.
I mean, I can confirm there are companies who have received sanctioning by the Russian authorities to come in region with TPM devices. So I can't name who they are, but they have gone through and they've got sanctioning by specific government officials. Hopefully, we won't need that soon. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question on the biometrics. It seems like it was unique to pick the fingerprint because as the it seems like the industry is beginning to go towards facial recognition on a lot of devices, and since every device basically has a camera now, I was wondering what the thought was on facial recognition biometrics in signing up.
That's a good question. So the question is basically related to, you know, why fingerprint versus other alternatives. So I believe the technology exists today to do facial recognition in a proper way. That technology doesn't exist in a price point that would work well. I think that the device sizes wouldn't be compatible with things like tablets. So it's technically possible, but we don't think we can get the prices where they need to be to make it mainstream. So fingerprints are something. Nelly, I didn't know you were here. So Nelly is the program manager lead for the biometrics group at Microsoft. So she had a comment.
It seems like that biometrics and hand biometrics had been around for a while, but it just seems like most of the industry and within customs and every place else, it seems like it's mainly going towards facial recognition.
Thank you, Nelly, and thank you for attending the session. I didn't know you were here. Great. Looks like we have another question towards the rear there.
Yeah, there was two features mentioned. There was it was machine remediation and account remediation. Account remediation, is that identity theft? What is that exactly?
So the last part of that was the account remediation for identity theft.
Yeah, identity theft. What is that?
It kind of is. Yeah. So what will happen is, let's imagine that that the provable PC Health cloud service was able to detect that it was a keylogger on the system. We would know that it's very, very likely that the intent of that was to steal your pet username and password. And so the account remediation then kicks in saying, hey, we believe based on the nature of what we found on your PC that your account has likely been compromised, although we don't know for sure. So we recommend that you go through a process of resetting your password, et cetera, so forth.
Okay. Thank you.
Perfect. Another question, in the back.
It seems like this is more on the personal end. And if you're looking in the corporate field, how does that work if I have to go from my personal account and switch it to my admin account for the biometrics? How would
Okay. So you would have to use another finger in this case. So you'd for your admin account, you may use your pinky.
Okay.
So you'd have to use a different finger.
Okay. And it, yes, if I don't want to use that, like what's the fall safe? Can I unplug it? Say it doesn't work for some reason.
Oh, can you revert back to some other form? Absolutely. Absolutely. So you can go back to, you could go to a picture password or a traditional password or maybe a virtual smart card. So it's one of the many options you can have registered. In fact, on my PC, you'll see that I have a series of options. I think we're going to get kicked out here. So let me just show one last thing here. You'll see that I've got all sorts of options here. I've got two virtual smart cards, a fingerprint, a password, and a picture.
Okay.
Okay. Perfect. Thanks. I'll take a few.